Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Imani Perry, whose new book is Black and Blues, How a Color Tells the Story of My People. Imani Perry is the Henry A. Morse Jr. and Elizabeth W. Morse Professor of Studies of Women, Gender, and Sexuality, and of African and African American Studies at Harvard University. She is the author of several books, including Looking for Lorraine, The Radiant and Radical Life of Lorraine Hansberry, and the National Book Award winner South to America, A Journey Below the Mason-Dixon to Understand the Soul of a Nation. Today, we're talking about her beautiful new book, Black and Blues, How a Color Tells the Story of My People. Imani Perry, I am so happy to welcome you back to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
Like South Toward Home, this gorgeous book is a journey, and the through line is the color blue. And that takes us back, of course, to the origin story of blue, the indigo crop, which, of course, has been so important in Louisiana history. And we're learning so much about indigo these days as if it's being rescued from history. So talk about going back to that area of scholarship.
Sure. You know, what's so profound about indigo, and really it's representative of the power of the color blue, is that it is a color that captured the imagination of the world. People were so taken by it. People were enchanted by it. And there were various places where it was cultivated. And what I was interested in was how to think about both the universality and the distinction of the relationship to this dye. And so what I mean is there were all these accounts that I was able to find about the cultivation of indigo in West Africa and Central Africa. But something happened in the moment of the transatlantic slave trade where a person went from being someone who cultivated indigo to someone who could be sold for a block of indigo. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to think about that kind of alienation of going from being someone who had personhood, who possessed themselves, who created, to being a product. And that is the kind of devastation in the history of Black people, but also this moment when the very idea of Black people was sort of created. So I wanted to think about, well, what does it mean to come out of such a tragic historical event and then create beauty nevertheless and develop a sense of personhood anew nevertheless? And so then with that, I then re-encounter indigo and talk about the taste for indigo that developed amongst Black people and the continued cultivation of indigo on this side of the Atlantic. So the history really opened up a way of thinking about life, mm-hmm. really.
Now, if there's one object that serves as an informing metaphor in this journey, it's the blue bead, which, of course, was used as currency, as adornment, and it's such a signal piece of American material culture. So I wish you'd talk a little bit about the myriad meanings of those beads.
Well, thank you. It's, again, one of these wonderful, powerful, sort of artifactual discoveries. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I started with the fact that there are archaeologists who have found blue beads that are buried with formerly enslaved people and burial grounds, sort of finding it as part of the material culture of plantation life. And then I started to dig further, thinking about, well, what was appealing about these blue beads? Why were they important? And that took me on a road, again, back to West Africa and the way in which beads were traded in faceted beads that were sparkling and beautiful, were traded as desirable goods between Europeans and often those Florentine beads and West Africans, and these moments again where there's the slippage between, okay, this is a beautiful artifact that everybody loves, but then also human beings are being sold. So the blue bead sort of allows us to go again across the oceans. It's used as a ballast. They're used as ballast on slave ships. They are traded. They're desired. They're often, a single bead is the one possession that the enslaved person might have it through the middle passage and in the desperate hold, the bottom of the ship, the sort of one piece of one precious object that reminded someone that they were a human being. And so I'm fascinated by the way something beautiful and enchanting is at once becomes a tool for suffering and the thing that allows people to continue to feel alive. So it's again, so it's one of those, and it has all these twists and turns. And it's interesting even that, Montesquieu, who really mocked Africans for finding these beads beautiful because they were seen as not particularly valuable to Europeans. And so even then you get the kind of evidence of the way in which hierarchies amongst human beings are being made in this era of conquest and the transatlantic slave trade.
And you make such brilliant connections across time and culture. And one chapter I'd really like to talk about a bit, which was, I guess, my favorite. It's hard to pick a favorite in this book because there's so much stuff. But it's the chapter called Blue Black Speller about George Washington Carver. And first, there's the power of the speller itself, that ubiquitous tool for learning to read and write. I wonder if you talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's this, you go in the archives and you find these remarkable stories of people whose names we know, but we don't necessarily delve into intimately. And George Washington Carver is one of these people who had, in some ways he just becomes this, like, he's the peanut guy. But once I started thinking about following the threads of his life, one, and it appears in his life, but in so many other people who made the transition from slavery to freedom, this blue back speller, this classic text for teaching reading that facilitated the autodidact, the person who was going to teach themselves, Webster's Blue Black Speller, Blue Back Speller.
I know, it's hard to say.
But it's described as this most precious thing over and over again in the lives of that generation. And you can see in the life of someone like George Washington Carver, who is clearly a genius, and is a genius who emerges from the condition of slavery, goes on to become a professor, but maintains this deep sense of intimacy with the people in the local community where he built his career, Tuskegee University. So the book is this pathway into a world of higher learning, but then he returns to the world from which he emerged in many ways. So he develops relationships with, poor folks in Tuskegee, and he is impressed by what he sees and the way they attempt to beautify their homes. And so that spurs him to think about how to create paints, how to create beauty for those people in return. He talked about, making beautiful colors for poor people. And I love him as a figure because he is so many things at once. And we tend to classify people as, a scientist or an artist or a hoodoo man. In some ways, he was all of the above. He was deeply spiritual. He was out in the woods talking to God. He was a scientist with the lab. He was making use of all these plants. He was a painter. He painted beautiful, large paintings, often of flowers. And he made this formula for Egyptian blue, which, we know the blue of Egypt has encapsulated the world in waves. And he created a formula for it when people in the West hadn't had one for years. So then you have all these paint companies coming down to Tuskegee to find this formula. So he's just a wonderful figure for thinking through all kinds of aspects of Black life. And he's also just absolutely compelling.
Well, I'm embarrassed to admit that I didn't know he was a painter. And so this sent me in search of images of his paintings online.
Yeah.
And they are glorious, especially
glorious.
His blues.
Yeah.
The color blue in his painting is extraordinary.
I mean, it was clearly a color that he loved. He also made a beautiful Prussian blue. He was so sensitive to the environment, and he was clearly an aesthete, and it was evident in everything, you know, the way that he wanted to have sweets for breakfast. All of the formula he made, right, he you know, introduced crop rotation. He was worried about people having land that they could actually work and sustenance, mm-hmm. but he also was always attentive to beauty and elegance as well. And so he had, you know, all these recipes for various kinds of treats, and he created beautiful paintings.
And he made fascinating connections. Like, I love that relationship of the sweet potato to the morning glory.
Yeah. It's so wonderful because I think the kind of connections that he made, they functioned as a kind of ethical lesson, which is, you know, there's these multiple uses for everything. He rejected assumptions on the surface of all kinds of natural objects. And that seemed to me to reflect his personal ethics. You know, when he said the quotation, the difference between a weed and a flower is a judgment.
Yes.
It's really an ethos. And that ethos is actually what enabled the discoveries.
And you, like him, connect science and art throughout this book, all the way at every step.
Yeah, which is funny because, you know, I was a math person, but I was not a science person growing up. But, you know, once you're talking about perception and creation, then you actually do have to approach science. And for me, writing the book in some ways demystified science, right? Because I'm always thinking about creativity, you know, music and art and dance. All of that has a great deal of science in it, right? And so Carver becomes this entry point for thinking we're all engaged in these kind of scientific endeavors when we want to create something. And in general, like this is part of why hoodoo is so essential to the book too, because hoodoo is this, you know, folk spiritual practice that in part is so powerful because it doesn't observe boundaries, right? It's something it'll have, some medicine, some science, some spirituality. But that's actually how the world is. You know, we categorize for the sake of study and organization, but when we really look at things, it's so much of it is a blend of the various categories that we tend to sort things into. So I felt sort of unleashed to have my kind of hoodoo aesthetic and to embrace the science that often intimidated me as I thought about the way blue moves in our lives.
That's it. It's these unlikely connections of science and art. And I was thinking about this. I thought, well, so much of this is history, but it's overlaid with this brilliant experience of emotion. And that almost translates into poetry. On every page, you know, there's something really beautiful to read.
Thank you. I mean, I feel like that's also part of the work of getting closer to being fully honest about who we are as learners.
Mm-hmm.
So coming through, you know, an academic context, you almost are forced to detach emotion from, you know, critical scholarly work. But we're always invested emotionally, right? Our curiosity is emotional. We're trying to make our way in the world. And so for me as a writer, I want to stage moments of a reunion between, you know, the critical, the intellectual, the theoretical, and the heart, which is really the thing that in some ways drives all of it, even if we don't admit it.
Did you feel like your writing was a little different in this book as you were writing?
You know, every book is different.
Yeah.
Yes. I think that the primary difference from South to America is that that book was so much a book of encounters. So there's lots of voices in it, right? So the craft of it is sort of trying to weave together the voices. These encounters were in artifacts and pages more exclusively, you know, and on images. And so it demanded a different kind of voice. But I think I'm also just consistently trying to develop as a writer to get closer to the artistic vision that is this sort of this space that all these different elements can sit together in a way that is harmonious and then becomes part of a composition that can include past and present and feeling and thought and story and sensibility at once.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Imani Perry, whose new book is Black and Blues, How a Color Tells the Story of My People. And so much of it is about how to experience something fully.
Yeah.
In all its complexity, yeah. I think. One example of that is the wonderful chapter on hoodoo, which offers a powerful lesson, as you say, move by hook or crook and make it pretty, that powerful disposition to life. So I wonder if you'd talk a little bit more about that, because that's a subject that's always of great interest to us here in Louisiana.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. For me, the turn to hoodoo is in some sense a turn to my own sense of rootedness. And by that I mean, in my academic training, I learned a good deal about Candomblé and Santeria and the coherent religious systems that were retentions of, you know, West Africa in the Americas, and understanding their organization and their logic and their theology. Hoodoo was something that, you know, you always have bits and pieces of it all around, and it's sort of you live with it, and there are certainly practitioners who were far more knowledgeable than I, but I had an awareness of it. But it really is like, it's like quilting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it has the same aesthetic and sensibility, which is you make this body of knowledge that is a resource to move through the world out of what you have at your hands, and you create something. And I, rather than thinking of that as a measure of something that is broken, I think of that as an incredibly important kind of creative practice for human beings. So for me to write and think about hoodoo and the way in which it moved and it impacted people far beyond what you would think of, you know, think about like the way someone like Faulkner, or in the pages of the Atlantic Monthly, you find references to hoodoo, as well as in local communities and artifacts and practices. It felt like part of the heart, really, of the case of the book.
And part of it relates to that Jewish belief in Tikkun Olam, the repair of the world.
Yes.
You know,
absolutely.
Re-knitting things, putting things back together. Which I thought was so interesting. But blues is everywhere, and that's one of the things you show us in this book, is how to read the world for blues in a way. And of course, it's perhaps best known in music and in literature, and you could have written whole books on those topics, as other people I have.
Mm-hmm.
But how hard was it for you to narrow it down to the ones you chose?
It was incredibly hard. I mean, the book, you know, and it really was a challenge, a craft challenge for me, because the book started out as a collection of essays. That's what I proposed, and that were on different aspects of blue and black life. And then I started to feel as though that wasn't really what I wanted. I wanted to tell a story. And so I needed a chronological aspect, and I wanted to capture the aesthetic of the blues and blue in practice. And that required a kind of putting pieces together in ways that are harmonious, in ways where you can see kind of recurrent themes, but also tensions and different ways in which, you know, blue and the blues show up in time and space. And so it was almost like having, I don't know, like a puzzle pieces that I was constantly sort of arranging and rearranging. And there were many things that I desperately loved that did not make it in the book, because I was trying to make it work as a composition, you know, which is as opposed to being comprehensive. I didn't want it to be too big a book, because I actually was thinking, well, this is a book that then you read and then you go into the world and you see the blues and you encounter the blues in a new way, right? And so it can't be too heavy, because it needs to be able to be something that people can take with them and then bring their own insights to bear.
It's a hard book to read straight through, because you want to stop and think Yeah. About each individual essay. I mean, they're all knit together, of course, but each one is so rich, you have to stop and really take it in, I think. Now, this book, like one of its chapters, Afro Blue, is a call to action. And I wonder if you'd read a bit for us from the end of that chapter where you're discussing the Miles Davis album, Kind of Blue.
Mm-hmm. In the same year as Afro Blue, the Miles Davis album, Kind of Blue, was released. Jazz critics describe it as one of the greatest albums of all time. This was 6 years after Davis's album Blue Period, which was aesthetically cool. On Blue Period, the track Bluing had the name of the laundry item used to keep whites bright and clean and the conjure ingredient for good root work. Davis was clever as well as brilliant. With an animated swing that sounds like the bustle of living, he paid appropriate homage to the tradition. But he also reached wide. The name Blue Period referenced Picasso, an artist who found inspiration in Africa, as if Davis chose to take back his root. The elliptical nature of Black art, departure and return, local and global, connected through empires though not reducible to them, was on full display. On the Blue Period album cover, the photograph of Miles is blue-toned, as though awash in the color. The cover and content of Kind of Blue, 6 years later, is different. Davis's face and body are not blue-toned, but he is a man dressed in blue, as though he wants listeners to understand that he has deliberately dressed himself in his musical tradition to make this album. Listen to it. The standard scales are gone. Instead, there are long, unchanging harmonies all throughout. Miles Davis of 1959 doesn't just give us jazz to listen to. He brings us inside the experimentation like a tour guide. Miles breathes audibly. The smokiness, the smoothness, the sustained respiration through change after change is magnificent. He, bourgeois dentist's son, erudite educated, posture so unflinching, performed a patterned dance of breath, breaking the rules of formal musical training. Movement is a divine word. To call organizing for freedom the movement was a strike of genius. The moves in our culture of art and performance, be they dancing, playing jazz, blues, or hambone, singing or hoofing, are all the art of living. And forgive us, Lord, for the Western sacrilege of sometimes being mere spectators to that divinity. It beckons participation. Miles told us with his breath, Mungo with his independence, Gonzalez with his permutations, the women of Montgomery with their walking, and Nina Simone with her refusal to be boxed into a genre. It was as though at every turn, the people shouted, move, and responded to themselves with action.
Oh, I love that. Movement is a divine word. I mean,
thank you. It is. And they made it. Yeah.
Imani Perry presents her book Tuesday, February 4th at 6 at George's Auditorium at Dillard University, presented by Baldwin & Company. This is a ticketed event. Thank you so much, Imani. I'm so grateful for this conversation and this book.
Oh, thank you as always.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Alexandra Davis presents Rise and Shine, It's Mardi Gras Time at a Mardi Gras Storytime Saturday, February 1st at 11 a.m. at Garden District Bookshop. Blue Cypress Books presents a celebration of Black romance writers featuring Darby Bayham, Farrah Roshan, A.H. Cunningham, and Scarlett Miller, Saturday, February 1st at 6 at Blue Cypress Books. Imani Perry presents her book, Black and Blues, How a Color Tells the Story of My People, Tuesday, February 4th at 6 at George's Auditorium at Dillard University. This is a ticketed event presented by Baldwin & Company. The Friends of the Jefferson Public Library will hold a general meeting on Wednesday, February 5th at 10 a.m. at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The guest speaker will be Elizabeth Trujillo, nutrition and community health agent from the Ag Center. She'll speak about the importance of protein and the diet. For more information, please call the Friends of the Jefferson Public Library at 504-455-2665 or email friendsjpl@yahoo.com. Tia Williams discusses and signs A Love Story for Ricky Wilde, Thursday, February 6th at 6 at Baldwin & Company. And coming up February 8th, the Friends of the Jefferson Public Library sponsor a warehouse sale Saturday, February 8th from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. That's at the hallway directly off the lobby at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Boxes of books, cookbooks, children's books, and regular fiction will be sold, labeled as to what they contained, but they cannot be opened before purchasing. Payment may be made using cash or credit card. For more info, please contact the Friends at 504-455-2665 or email friendsjpl@yahoo.com. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.